Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Podfather. My name is Alex, and I am joined, as always, by Jordan.
Hello.
I wanted to start today's episode off with a slightly serious conversation. Anthony Bourdain sadly passed away last week. It was a suicide. And I just wanted to ask you, Jordan, because I think it's good to have a public conversation about this stuff. If the Podfather can do anything to better the world, maybe it's this. So I just wanted to ask, how is your mental health going, Jordan?
Well, first I'll talk about this Anthony Bourdain thing, because I actually, like, I knew of him, but I really didn't know anything about his work, except that he was a chef, a TV chef.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the last week, I've seen this outpouring of, like, support, but also just that people were clearly huge fans of this guy.
Yeah.
And so I've looked into his body of work, and he's kind of like a gonzo celebrity chef, isn't he? Like,
yeah, of the 21st century.
Yeah, and like one of his cookbooks was the cover illustration is Ralph Steadman, who actually did the illustration for Fear and Loathing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, so like, I mean, it's really sad that this is the reason why, but I've found him really interesting over the last week, and I look forward to sort of going through his work now.
I think you'd enjoy him, actually. And you know what? I'm not the biggest fan. I've always loved him, but I haven't really delved in and watched all of his shows or read any of his books. I've always just kind of seen it around and enjoyed it a lot. But I've never known anyone who actually doesn't like him. I've never heard anyone say a bad thing about him, actually.
But you're right. It's it is important to talk about mental health because it's one of the like top killers of men in particular is suicide. I mean, and women, of course, but the percentage is a little higher in men. And I think it's because, and we, to bring it back to the podcast, we do see this in a lot of the movies we watch, is that men are sort of conditioned to be these tough guys, and that can come at a real cost to one's mental health.
That's very true. And gangster movies often perpetuate that idea, I think, as well, in a negative way.
Yeah. And like, I'm watching Breaking Bad at the moment, rewatching it, and I'm up to the point where Hank has sort of, he's suffering from kind of PTSD and stuff, but he's, anytime there's another guy around, he just puts on a brave face, and makes a joke. And so I do think it's a really serious thing that not only is important to talk about outside of what we talk about on the podcast, but also does really tie into what we do talk about on the podcast. I think that more men should talk about their mental health because, yeah, we're sort of conditioned to view it as weak, and that can kind of be disastrous.
Definitely, definitely. And what I often find is that, for me personally anyway, just hearing some people have a frank conversation about it, sometimes on podcasts or like on YouTube or something like that, I think that's really helpful because it's not like you're, you know, having to go into therapy or something. You're just kind of hearing the conversation, and it can kind of make you think about yourself and realize things or just kind of help in a way, you know?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And the thing about what you're saying about therapy is oftentimes you see men sort of use the women in their life as quasi-therapists, and that sort of intimate relationship is often sort of tied with that, whereas generally women talk about this kind of stuff with their friends a lot more.
Yes.
And yeah, which is it's a terrible burden to put on someone that you're intimate with, is, you know, putting the sole burden of your own problems onto someone else. But often that's what you find as well, which is also not good. So it's important, I think, that men talk about their mental health with their friends.
With their friends, yes, it's also good to talk about it with your partners. But going back to that point, you know, you wouldn't expect your partner to fix your broken leg. You know, they don't know how to do that. That's for the hospital to do. So it's a kind of that. I know that's a bit of a cliche analogy these days, but it's true. Like, you know, obviously you need to talk to the people who you are close to, but also people need to be more comfortable in talking to professionals about that kind of stuff. There's a good podcast I've been listening to lately, which I think I've mentioned Casey Neistat on here before, yeah. Right? But you don't really watch him.
Yes, that's exactly right.
He has a new podcast with his wife. They call it Couples Therapy. And I actually thought it was going to be a little bit cringy and kind of weird going into it, but they just have really frank conversations about their relationship. They talk about how they do sometimes go and see a third party therapist. They actually do, you know, sort of the couples therapy thing. And listening to them talk about it is just really interesting, eye-opening, and makes you think about yourself a little bit, like I said before, in your own relationships, or, you know, thinking that you do to sometimes need someone else to have another view on it, you know?
Yeah. Well, listeners, well, this is sort of an encouragement, I guess, to make sure that, you know, if you need help, talk to someone. And it doesn't have to be a professional, because that can be really daunting. But make sure that you're talking to someone, certainly. Because personally, I really try to avoid talking about my mental health at any cost. I really dislike it. I don't like people seeing me in a way that I can't control. Mm. I like to sort of know what I'm putting out there and make sure that it's sort of sculpted the way I want. And talking about mental health stuff doesn't often fit into that fun-loving persona.
Does that come from the performing aspect of your character in life, do you think?
I don't know, to be honest. It's just I just don't like talking about it. I used to, like in high school, I would talk about it a lot more, but now maybe because of that I don't talk about it as much, because maybe I see it as a bit more of a thing of the past. But yeah, there's probably times I should have gone and seen someone, like in the not too recent past, I probably should have. Like I'm good now, you don't have to worry, listeners. But yeah, there are times I probably should have gone to see someone, I think.
Well, I think you should anyway, possibly, maybe even just to debrief about it, because that's something that I've been thinking about doing. I have seen someone in the past. Not for a while now, but I've been thinking about maybe just following up with it when I get back to Australia and just debriefing on what's changed since then. Because I don't think I necessarily need it at the moment. I think I'm doing pretty well too. But I did want to maybe just revisit it just as a way to offload and to see, you know, the state of the union, so to speak, in my little head.
Yeah, and sometimes you can't sort of know these things until you hash them out with someone and a professional who's sort of trained to deal with that sort of stuff is often the best way to go.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you're quite right. Just because things are going well now is no reason not to see someone, particularly like, cause in Australia you can get, what is it? 10 free, psych sessions with the Medicare or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. We've got really great stuff in Australia. So if you are listening in Australia, just use those outlets. They're available. They're not, you know, necessarily pasted on the walls everywhere, easy to find. But if you do a bit of a Google, you can find out. That also reminds me, I've seen lately, there's a lot more kind of like online services and like sort of new aspects and ideas that you can sort of log on to and talk to someone, or there's, you know, there's all these new ways of help, which is good as well. So if you do, just have a little bit of a Google. See what's out there. Or drop us a line. I'm happy to talk to you.
Absolutely. No, likewise. And I think there's a sort of a bit of a stigma with the whole thing. Even still, you know, I think everyone's a bit more accepting of mental illness as illness and as something that people deal with, and it's a legitimate thing. But there's still, I think, a bit of distance when it comes to your own, you're like, oh, I understand
exactly,
that
yeah,
people
yeah.
need it and it's perfectly normal to do so, but I don't need to. I think that's often a big part of it for people.
Definitely.
And that can be one of the big barriers to push through in terms of like getting help, I guess, is not being afraid to ask for it.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that struck me about Anthony Bourdain and other suicides from celebrities in the last couple of years. You know, the thing that's surprising is like, you know, these people are obviously well off and they've probably got good support networks. And you would assume that if they did have issues that they needed to speak to someone about, that they would have sort of had that under control. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily how suicide works. There's a really good article that I'll link to that I read about this specific case, which I think sums it up really well. But I think that's why I brought it up. And I don't want this podcast to turn into something that it isn't. We're not healthcare professionals. But yeah, I think it's just raising the awareness more. And yeah, like
starting
you said,
a conversation.
It's a double standard. Starting a conversation. Make sure you talk to someone.
Yeah.
Moving on from that, let's talk about someone who does need mental treatment. President Donald Trump has fired back at Robert De Niro. I just
what a segue.
Thought we would just mention this. Thank you. I thought we'd just mention this. Our good friend, old Bobby De Niro, got up at the Tony Awards. I watched the video last night. Have you seen it?
Yes, I have. It's very funny. Did you see the uncensored version?
Yeah, I did.
Good.
He just gets on stage and says, I don't even know if I can repeat what he says. I feel like the CIA might come to my window. He says, fuck Trump. And then he holds his fists up like he's in Raging Bull or something like that. And he's like standing there. So he obviously feels very strongly about it.
He gets a bloody standing ovation.
He gets a standing ovation. All the good old lefties in the Hollywood community or the theater community. It was fantastic. President Trump tweeted about this. I just want to read this out because I like reading Donald Trump tweets. Robert De Niro, a very low IQ individual, has received too many shots to the head by real boxers in movies.
But he spells too wrong. When he says too many, it's the wrong two.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's the wrong two, yeah. T.O. I watched him last night and truly believe he may be punched drunk. I guess he doesn't realize the economy is the best it's ever been. Shut up. Wake up, Punchy. What do you make of that, Jordan? What do you make of our Hollywood heroes getting involved in politics in such a striking way?
Well, it's funny because a lot of people sort of say, stay in your lane, stick to your day job with that sort of thing. But I kind of think that's bullshit. like people should be able to speak their political views. I think just because you're a person of high profile or a celebrity or famous, that shouldn't mean that you can't then say what you think or feel on an issue. And people will either take your own view on board or they won't. But I think you've got a right to express that. And that's why, like, particularly Twitter is a lot of celebrities speaking their minds on these sort of issues. And you can sort of ignore it or enjoy it or neither. Something like this, though, I don't know that it helps. Like, it's funny and I enjoy it and I love that he hates Trump. Like, personally, I'm not a fan of the Trump presidency at all.
No, the Podfather does not endorse the Trump presidency, just on record.
No, engaging in this sort of thing, like, kind of reinforces the perceived notion of leftist politics. And I just think, like, I don't know if you've seen anyone responding on Twitter, like, people are like, you know, I used to love Robert De Niro, but now I'm happy to discard him for my president and my America, blah, 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 blah. I know it's kind of makes you vomit a little bit, but I feel like if he had just said something like, you know, who knows? These people are kind of delusional, in my opinion, thinking that Trump is a good leader. But I don't know, if there's a bit more nuance to the conversation, sometimes people don't just switch off. And you see it on both sides of politics.
Yeah, yeah.
But as enjoyable as it was, I just don't know if that's the right way to go about changing people's mind. He's kind of preaching to the choir. And I guess he literally was, because he was in a room full of people that would have loved that comment. And now it's only us on the other side of the camera, the broader audience, that are dissecting it in a different way.
And I guess it's a little bit sensationalist in the same way that Trump is. It's almost like, you know, Trump will say crazy things, and De Niro's almost done the same thing. He's just said something kind of a bit crazy just to, you know, maybe not just to get attention, but it almost seems like it's now just people barking on both sides. And it, like you said, not very constructive.
No, but I'll be damned if I didn't have a big grin on my face watching that footage.
I know.
And it's not the first time he's said something like that either. He told the press like ages ago now that he would love to like punch Donald Trump in the face, didn't he?
That's right.
Like, this isn't the first time he said something like this.
Well, thanks, Bobby. One last thing from me is I received a comment from longtime listener, 1.5 time guest. I think I said she was a 2 or 3 time guest the other day, but that's not actually true. She's only been a guest once, and then she provided audio commentary once. So 1.5 time guest, I think, is the tally. She said, and Mari Law, this is, if you don't know her already, she said that 1 hour is too long for a Podfather episode. Well, you're in luck, Mari Law, because we've been working on something for the last couple of weeks that will aid that problem. If you've been listening to the episode so far, you know that we like to waffle on before we talk about the movie. So Jordan has painstakingly dissected all 50 of our episodes and provided me with the time at which we start talking about the movie. And then I have painstakingly gone through all 50 episodes and edited the descriptions. So when you look at the description of the episode in your podcast player of choice, there will be a little line of text at the bottom that says skip to the movie, and it gives you a time. So if you don't want to hear us talking shit for 10, 15, sometimes 30 minutes, you can just skip straight to the movie. And we don't talk about the movie normally for too long. So if you just want to hear what we say about the movies, skip to the movie. Available across all episodes.
And if you just want to hear us talk shit, you can stop at the allocated time.
Exactly, yeah. So you've got three choices. You can hear us talk shit, you can hear us talk about the movie, or you can have the whole Podfather experience.
And I would like to know if other listeners are feeling the same way, and if so, what would you like less of? Like we've kind of kept the structure similar, and we no longer review biscuits, which took up a significant chunk of time. Is it just that we waffle a bit too long? And I think part of that is that we can't see each other at the moment when we're recording, so it does tend to get a bit waffly, a bit monologue-y. But yeah, listeners, if you have any feedback, we always like to hear from you. So thanks, Mari Law, for sending in that feedback. Hopefully,
thank you.
This timestamp thing will fix some of your issues. But if not, please let us know what else we can do.
Please let us know.
Okay. Well, both Alex and I like to go to the movies. Alex obviously works at a cinema. I spend at least 2 days a week at the cinema watching movies, usually. One of the last movies I saw was 2001, A Space Odyssey, at the Astor Theatre on 70mm. film, and let me tell you, I'd seen this movie once before on a screen in one of my friends' bedrooms in year 11 or something, and to see it on the big screen was incredible. That opening bit where the titles come up, the dum 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 dun dun. honestly, I nearly I started to tear up.
It's powerful.
Like, it gave me like goosebumps to watch that. And then the rest of the movie, I don't know if it's like a great, it's not like necessarily the best narrative movie of all time. Like, no one says it is. But as far as cinematic experiences go, it is something that every single person who likes going to the movies, should see on a big screen, because it's mind blowing. And to see the practical effects up close on a big screen,
yeah,
and to hear that soundtrack loud in your ears is kind of just incredible. And to hear people laugh, that's one of the, like, when I said this a couple months ago now, but when I saw Dr. Strangelove at the Astor, and to hear people laugh at the jokes, it just is such an enriching experience. And a few parents were there with, like, 7-year-old kids, like, or maybe 9-year-old kids.
Oh, my God.
And I thought, that's such an interesting choice too. And the kids were going, what's happening? What's this mean? Throughout. But honestly, even the grown-ups leave that movie thinking, what did that mean? What's going on? But to see it in that context it was really incredible. And I recommend trying to go and see one of these 50th anniversary prints, or even just the 4K restoration or whatever it is. Go and see it on a big screen this year.
See it on a big screen this year. I'm going to be seeing it hopefully in July at the BFI. It's also showing, I know, at the Sun Theatre, where Nick went to go see it as well last
week. Yes, I saw him the other day right before he did that, because we went to the football with Tim.
Nice, nice. I totally agree with everything you said. I mean, yeah, like you said, it's not necessarily the best movie of all time. I wanted to ask you, do you think it's still... Because I personally think it still holds up. We were talking about in a movie last week that probably doesn't hold up anymore. Do you think this movie... I personally think you could play this movie next to any movie released in the years since, and it would still look and feel just as good, if not a lot of the time better than some of the movies that have come since.
Yeah, well, I think the fact that there's so many practical effects is just... That just does wonders for the movie. Of course, there are a few things like... a couple of, like, the spacecrafts flying past planets that look a little off, in the same way that, you know, the old Superman movie looks a bit off when that kind of thing happens. But the stuff like the rotating sets, those kind of effects are just as mind-boggling now as they were then.
And they're so flawlessly done.
And because it's just optical illusion, it's really hard to fault that stuff, because it's all practical. You don't feel like, oh, this has been shot and then we're moving into a computer now. It's like, no, how is she walking upside down?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Oh, it's incredible. It's really incredible.
And it becomes slightly more incredible if you're into that kind of thing when you look up how they did it. That kind of almost helps to enhance. That's like, because it's so simple, but also, like I said, flawlessly done. You need to make sure everything's correct and meticulous. And that's what I love about Kubrick. I feel like he's very meticulous.
Even knowing how it's done it's an optical illusion. So knowing how it works doesn't make it not work, which is incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
Quickly, speaking of Kubrick, it's just been announced that they are going to make a film out of Stephen King's sequel to The Shining.
Oh.
I think it's called Dr. Sleep. And it's the kid from The Shining, but grown up, is the plot. And they've cast Ewan McGregor as the kid as an adult.
To play him.
Yeah, I'm kind of intrigued about that. Because that's kind of a Stephen King trope, isn't it? Because, like, in It, for instance, the kids grow up later in one of the other parts of the book. And they've cast that movie too, the sequel to It is coming out. Well, they're going to start filming it, and they've cast all those kids too. I think it's an interesting device for horror, because it's like you can see the same monster come back, or the same, you know, horror element come back and see how it affects someone, and you can delve into childhood trauma and stuff. I think it's pretty cool.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. Doesn't sound too exciting for me. Because I kind of think The Shining just, I don't know, like, I don't know, can't they just, it would be nice if they could just make a sequel, but not say it's the kid like that. I'm starting to get a bit sick of that kind of stuff, because it's kind of like, I just want to leave that story all buttoned up as it was, you know, because I think it's perfect as it is.
It's not like something like Blade Runner, where they're, it's kind of, they're just adapting another book, with this one. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, so it was the book sequel.
So they're making a film.
I don't know a lot about Stephen King, except that so many of his books have been made into movies, possibly more than anyone else. Is that correct? I don't know.
Well, he's written a lot of books too.
He's written a lot of fucking books.
Under the Dome, for instance, that TV show, that was a Stephen King book. The Dark Tower came out recently. Everyone just loves Stephen King. I'm not a horror guy, so I don't really care too much, to be honest. You went to the movies a few days ago, I believe.
Well, I was at work, so I got to watch Scarface.
Which one?
Which was exciting, the 1983 one. So it was a lifelong dream of mine to watch that movie in the movie theater. Because as we've spoken about a lot recently, that definitely changes the experience a lot of the time. It was, first of all, very interesting to see the type of crowd that came to see the movie. That's one thing that I've been noticing a lot lately working at the cinema is just the different types of crowds you get and sometimes how they can be very movie specific. And Scarface was one of those films where you had the core group of moviegoers like me or you that kind of, I would say, go to see anything from Scarface to 2001 to a new movie like Call Me By Your Name or whatever, like that kind of group. But then you had these sort of auxiliary people who walked in who you could tell, like, A, had probably never been to the Prince Charles Cinema before, and B, have only come out of the woodwork to watch Scarface. I found that entertaining. There was this one girl who had this, like, jumper with Tony Montana printed on it, and it was pretty entertaining, and people were pretty excited, and there was quite a few couples, and I felt like telling them if she hasn't seen this movie before, it's not going to go well because I've made that mistake in the past. And I was expecting that since I haven't watched Scarface alone actually ever in my life. The first time I watched it was with my parents. Then the second time was with my uncle. He didn't like it. Then I watched it with long-time listener, 1.5-time guest Mari Law. She didn't like it. Then I watched it with you. You didn't like it. So I've kind of felt like Jesus on the cross and they've thrown stones at me every single time I've watched the movie. And
that's a bit
this
dramatic.
Time, well, it was a profound movie. I would honestly say that this movie is probably what actually flicked the cinema switch in my head. I think this was the movie that did it for me. So it's always close to my heart because of that. After watching it in a fresh mind, alone, without anyone to shit-talk it, I've come out of the experience not any better than I was before. And I've realised that the first hour is probably really still quite good and amazing. And that's where a lot of the good quotes and scenes and exciting bits are. And, you know, like we've probably said in our episode about it, you can't fault it for being iconic or quotable or influential in cinema and society particularly. But particularly in the second hour of the movie, it just doesn't actually go anywhere interesting, and it's a bit just tragic and depressing. And I think even though it's one of Al Pacino's best characters, he gets to a certain point where he stops developing and then it's just kind of like, it's just not, and it's almost like a one-time watch. I think the more you watch it, and I've seen it, I guess, five times now, the more you watch it, it doesn't actually get better, which is very different to something like The Godfather, which every time I watch that movie, I think it's better than the last time I watched it. Yeah. And I think that's quite fascinating and an interesting point of cinema, honestly, that you can have these two completely different reactions where something gets better with age or multiple viewings, and then something can get worse with multiple viewings.
Well, I'm actually really glad to hear you say that. Like, sad for you that a movie that you did really like has become maybe not as powerful as it was the first time, because that's never fun. But I'm glad that you're seeing the film in a more mature light, perhaps.
Thanks, Jordan.
I'm trying to make that sound not as condescending as it probably is.
But it's no, it also makes me think it's no surprise that the parts of the movie that are so well known are quite small and specific little moments. And it's almost like if you just did a supercut of those bits, well, that's kind of all you need to know in a funny way, you know? Because unlike The Godfather, another, I know I keep comparing it to that, but or even something like Goodfellas, you know, they have much more to talk about with character development, intertwining stories, you know, what does this mean? What does that mean? What's happening here? Scarface doesn't have a lot of that. It's kind of just, it's all in front of you, you know? So yeah, it lacks the depth that those movies
do. There's not as much to dissect. You are right. They hand it all to you.
Well, we've been talking for a long time today. Should we talk about the movie?
I'm really excited to talk about the movie today. I realized when I was watching this, I either haven't actually ever seen this movie the whole way through before, or I have, but didn't remember it. Because I remember the start, like the rounding up of the gang, because I remember definitely Don Cheadle going, "Oh, leave it out. Hello, I'm Don Cheadle, isn't it, right? Hello, I'm Don." Yeah, anyway, so I remember that bit, but I realized that I hadn't seen the whole thing in memory. So I was along for the ride. All the twists were fresh, everything. And let me tell you, I love this movie so much, Alex.
Me too. What a fucking movie.
Oh, yes. Look, we agreed last week on how shit the original was. We're agreeing today. Listeners, this is a miracle as far as I'm concerned.
A miracle. 2 weeks we're agreeing. In a row.
Yeah.
Maybe the podcast is bad then. We should be pitting ourselves against each other.
No. Ocean's 11, 2001 is just good.
It's an instant classic. And the first thing I'll say about it is that it definitely compared to the original, you know, within the first 5 to 10 minutes of the original, you go from a great title sequence to, okay, what's going to happen to, oh, fuck, I'm bored. In this movie, you go from an also pretty good title sequence to, oh, hi, George Clooney. Oh, man, he's got charm and charisma, and what's going to happen, and what's he doing, and what's this, and what's that? And, like, it's just, it definitely feels like an instant classic. You know, it just, it fits.
And it's just a fun movie. Sometimes you want to go and watch a movie and it just be fun. And that's what this is. And it's because there's kind of, whereas the last one, the original, so much of the time was spent like, oh, look how charming we all are. But this one was just about the heist. If there's not a scene that doesn't relate directly to the heist, it's not in the movie.
And even when you think it's not going to be about the heist, spoilers for the rest of the movie, the stuff with Julia Roberts, the stuff with his wife, even when you think that's a subplot, that actually kind of comes back into being part of the heist anyway, you know?
Yeah, and I will say I think that's the one weak link of the movie is the Julia Roberts storyline, that I just think him trying to get his ex back when everything the movie tells us about their relationship, it tells us that it wasn't a good relationship. Like she mentions that she cried all the time when they were together and stuff like that. So I think that is one of the weak points of the movie is that he does this to try and get her back. I do think that that is a weak point, but the rest of the movie is so good that it kind of doesn't matter. And then they make up for it in the sequel when Julia Roberts actually gets things to do. In this movie, she kind of gets nothing to do, but except keep a secret. But in the sequel, she gets more to do, and that kind of makes up for it for me. And like I said, the fact that the rest of the movie, and also the fact that that does lead to dramatic tension within the rest of the group, I think this is a really just fun and well-executed heist movie with a lot of twists and turns that you don't see coming. Oh, it's just, it just puts a smile on my face. I don't think it's the best movie we've watched, but it's maybe one of the funnest.
100%. And especially since we've started doing these heist or caper films, you know, it's up there with The Sting in that category. And I think it's actually, I feel like it takes a lot from The Sting in a funny way, because it just kind of has a lot more of that kind of con man attitude, and they sort of have their own lingo sometimes, and there's this kind of, you know, especially George Clooney has this cool factor about him where he kind of knows everyone and knows how to get things done. And like, it's just, it's got the aura and the feel of what the heist movie should have. And it takes you through the plan, doesn't tell you all the plan, leaves surprises, has montages, paced well, you know, it almost like The Sting has those title cards for the different sections. This movie almost has those different sections as well, just not quite as obviously in the way that they sort of lay it all out to you.
Yeah. So I didn't really write a lot of notes because I was kind of totally engrossed in the movie, but I wrote a few. And because I did want to think about it in relation to the original, because that's the way that we're viewing these movies. Basically, all I wrote was that the pace was faster and that there was not as much dead weight. And whereas in the other one, you sort of didn't get a sense that they really planned it all that well because there was only that one scene. In this movie, they have heaps of planning. So you think you know every detail of the heist. But then as a viewer, you get the joy of knowing that you didn't know all the details at the end and that there's more to it than everybody knows. And I think that is why The Sting worked, because there were bits left to the audience to find out towards the end. And that's why this movie works, because you only find out certain parts of the plot, even though you think you know it all, towards the end. That's just like heist movie magic.
And it's the deception that you also realize the characters knew more than you as well. You know, like it's that kind of feeling of like, oh, they had a trick up their sleeve. You know, you kind of feel conned by, I think we said this in The Sting, it's like you feel conned by the characters, and that's part of it.
Yeah. And I think any movie, it doesn't have to be a heist movie, when there's a twist and it works, that is why people go to the movies. And it's like with The Usual Suspects, for instance. The reason why people talk about that movie so much, and particularly the ending, is because of the twist. If there was no twist, people maybe wouldn't care about the movie as much.
Definitely.
Same with like M. Night Shyamalan movies. His whole career is based on the idea that audiences love a twist. So I think a well-executed twist is kind of one of the most useful weapons in a filmmaker's arsenal. And this movie has a couple. You think you've been hoodwinked and then you find out that maybe you weren't, or there's another one to come. And the original had that very one twist at the end, which made the end of the movie at least slightly enjoyable, but the rest of the movie couldn't make up for it. Whereas this movie has twists, but has the groundwork to back them up.
Definitely. And I think it's interesting that we're learning this new formula, because I think, you know, we've learned a lot about the gangster movie formula, and we often ask, you know, what makes a gangster movie? Is it a gangster movie? And now we're finding out what makes a heist movie. And in the world of crime films, it's amazing that there are such contrasting different formulas and ideas. And I love that. And I love that these heist movies are so much brighter and funner and just as satisfying, sometimes if not more satisfying to watch than some kind of long form gangster saga, because they hit these different, they scratch different itches in your entertainment mind, you know, and it's great that they can be kind of, you know, a gangster movie and a heist movie. I think we're learning they're a bit adjacent. They can kind of, they can cross over and they can be different. And it's great that we can have that and there can be so much difference and so much to look forward to and enjoy from these two different genres, that subgenres within sort of the one genre of being a crime movie, you know?
Yeah. Well, before we talk about, I really want to talk about the cast, but before we do that, I do want to talk about one other little similarity between this and the original that I noticed, which was in the original, we talked about how there's those cuts that happen when the camera pans up past the balloon and then you're in the other casino.
They did a throwback to that, yeah.
Yeah, there's one cut in Ocean's 11, 2001, where the cut is between two balloons. And I just thought, for the most part, the movie kind of ignores that the original ever happened. Like, there's no Frank Sinatra music or anything, for instance. But the balloon little cut, I thought was a nice little nod to one of the best parts about the original.
Yeah, I think it ignores it, but there was the balloons, there was the fact that there was the power outage, there was a shot at the end where they're all kind of walking. Like, I think they did a couple of subtle but well-executed throwbacks to the original that you would have absolutely no idea about unless you watched the original. Like, I wouldn't have thought twice about those things when I watched the movie for the first time, but now that I've seen the original and now seen this one, it's like, oh, that's a little throwback. That's cute, you know, sort of paying homage to the fact that we've taken the name and not taken much else.
Yeah.
And don't forget, it's three casinos instead of five casinos. They actually scaled back the ambitions.
Yes, which I think works for this film.
And also, sorry, on that, it's the same. I think in the original one, the plan is to they just kind of walk out with the money, right? That they have that little moment of like, how are you going to get it out? We'll just walk out with it.
Yeah.
And that was actually the same in the 2001 Ocean's 11, how are you going to get the money out? We'll just walk out with it. But the way they walk out with it in Ocean's 11, 2001 is clever and drastically different to what they do in the original.
Yeah. I kind of want to say, like, we haven't really spoiled anything yet. If you haven't seen Ocean's 11, what are you doing? Go see it. Ocean's 8 is out now, and definitely go and see that because we're going to talk about that next week. But Ocean's 11 and 12 and 13, if you're interested, and now 8, are all part of the same franchise. So there's no harm in seeing Ocean's 11 before you see Ocean's 8. I don't think.
Oh, I already want to ask questions about Ocean's 8, but I can't. I haven't even seen it. You've seen it. I want to ask you about it, but I have to wait till
next
week.
You've seen the trailer, yeah? You've seen the trailer?
Yeah, I have a while ago. Well, okay, the only question I want to ask in contrast to this movie is, is there anything from 12 or 13 that relates to 8? Like, do people need to see those two as well? Well, not need to, but like, or is just seeing Ocean's 11 okay, then going to see Ocean's? You know what I'm trying to say? Like, does it really intertwine?
I didn't watch 12 and 13 before I saw 8, but I did recently watch 11, and that was more than enough.
Good, good.
I'm glad I did. I'm glad I did watch this one first, but 12 and 13, you don't need to worry too much about.
Beautiful. Okay, well, shall we talk about the cast then?
Let's talk about the cast.
The extensive cast.
Clooney, perfect Danny Ocean. And whereas the first movie, it's Frank Sinatra's movie, really, this one, like, Danny kind of gets sidelined for part of the middle of the movie. And I think that really works fine because the rest of the cast is so good. They kind of take over the heist. Brad Pitt is like, nah, sorry, it's too personal, man. You need to get out of the heist. Which I did like. I did like that they addressed that, that the personal element might not be the best for the heist. And, of course, Brad Pitt is just delicious in this movie. He's always eating. He's uber charming. He's got the short hair.
Always eating.
He is. Every scene, more or less. And then, of course, you've got Damon playing a bit of a clueless type, but a clever clueless, which is in stark contrast to the role that he would later sort of get blockbuster famous on, which was Jason Bourne. So I always kind of like that, that the characters are so different. And then you've got, like we said last week, you've got Casey Affleck and Scott Caan. As the two brothers, and they're pretty good value. Like, they are quite funny, I think. And then the rest of them, I mean, there's Don Cheadle, of course, doing that really bad, really bad British accent. And then the rest of them are sort of a bit more minor, would you say?
We're in Barney Rubble.
Barney Rubble.
Barney
We're in
Rubble.
Barney, mate. Barney Rubble. Trouble. It's like, I feel bad for him because clearly he didn't have a good vocal coach because he's quite a good actor. But the accent sort of takes you out of it, doesn't it?
It's a bit much. But no, yeah, the cast is fantastic. I think I said this last week. The way that they give everyone a different, distinct job to do, I love that. You know, you early, as they're recruiting and as you watch the movie unfold, you realize what they're going to be doing. So, Basher's the electrics guy, the amazing Yen's the grease man, the twins are kind of just there to run interference and cause havoc. And they're so sectioned off and so specific compared to the original, where you kind of, like we said, they all look the same and you got no idea what the fuck they're all doing. And then all of a sudden they rob the casinos. So there's a lot more depth with the characters, even though some of them are only in it for brief sections. Mm.
Well, you talked about Yen. I want to talk about him for a minute, because that's one of the characters that I think isn't particularly treated all that well in the movie. Nah. He's kind of the quote-unquote token Asian, and he's sort of used because he's a contortionist and an acrobat, and he can get the job done. Fun fact about the actor, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but it's like Quinn Chabot. And his only acting credits are the Ocean's movies, because he is an acrobat and contortionist first and foremost, which I think is really cool. But it is a bit of a shame that he's kind of, I don't want to say exploited, but certainly used a bit more than some of the other characters in the movie.
And his role in the heist is pretty integral.
Yeah. Yeah, for the amount of work that he does, he doesn't get the comeuppance he deserves.
I'm trying to think of what other type of movies his talents would be good for, because you'd think after being in this movie, maybe he would have gone on to do some other roles. But I guess a contortionist or acrobatics kind of guy, okay, heist movies, yes. Then, like, circus movies, maybe? Like, there's not a lot that I guess his talents lend to for the film industry, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It's quite story specific, isn't it?
I guess so. And I guess he could have looked for other work as a, you know, supporting character, but at least he's one of the 11 main characters in this
one,
I guess.
Do you think there's a scene in the movie where Brad Pitt and George Clooney go and watch a show and they find the amazing Yen? Do you think that's actually what happened in real life? George Clooney and Brad Pitt went to go watch this guy performing and they were like, oh, that's our grease man.
Probably. And then you've got, outside of the 11, you've got Andy Garcia, who plays Terry Benedict.
He was great. I think this is like the second or third time. No, I think it's the third time I've seen this movie. And every time, you know, they do a bit of foreshadowing about Terry Benedict, and then he comes into the movie and he's just got a nice evil look. Like, Andy Garcia does a good job of just portraying this guy who's, you know, in control of his casinos and no one likes him, and, you know, he's got the girl. He fits it really well.
What I like about it is that in another movie, say the casino version of this movie, he's the hero. And that would have worked fine too, because Andy Garcia is so charismatic in his own way. But in this movie, you totally buy him as someone that we're not supposed to like.
Exactly.
And then, of course, you've got the one woman in the movie, Julia Roberts. And she doesn't really get a lot to do in this movie as Tess.
No.
However, a fun little bit of trivia about the movie. When they sent her the script to this, George Clooney sent her the script with a $20 bill attached to it, and said, with a note that said something like, I hear you're getting 20 per movie now, because she was like, this is early 2000s. So she's had all her Notting Hills and all that stuff. She was earning 20 million per movie. To get her for this movie is in this kind of shitty role, to be honest, is actually a pretty good get, and it gives a bit of gravitas to an otherwise kind of meaningless tokenistic role in the movie.
Sure, sure.
The fact that it's Julia Roberts means that we think that we should care about her, I guess.
Yes, and one thing that I like about this movie is I've always seen it as a bit of a time capsule of that era. Like, the cast is so indicative of who was the big shots, or maybe up and comings, but, you know, I guess Matt Damon has solidified himself since then. It's just a bit of a time capsule of who was who in the zoo, as Warren Amster says, of that time. And the fact that she's there solidifies that as well, you know?
Yes, I guess that's exactly right. Speaking of the who's who of the time, there's one bit where Brad Pitt's character, Rusty, is teaching cards to two up-and-coming actors, and they were playing themselves. It's Topher Grace and what's his name? I can't remember.
The funny thing about Topher Grace was there was a little line about how he was making a transition from TV to film, and they make a joke about it. And I thought that was kind of sad because the joke was on him because he never became a big movie star.
Yeah, that's true. Well, what I like about that moment is that it sort of sets up the trend in the Ocean's movies of having actors playing themselves in these movies. Obviously, spoilers for Ocean's 12 here, but there's that whole bit where Tess Ocean has to pretend to be Julia Roberts. But you've seen.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And Bruce Willis shows up and almost spoils their plan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I almost want to watch them now.
Yeah, I'm probably going to do
but
so.
But those movies,
well.
Okay. So, but I think, okay, I think compared to Ocean's 11, 12 and 13 start to be, yeah, a little bit more meta, a little bit more funny, a bit silly, less of a serious, like I think this is actually like quite a serious heist crime movie to go up with the greats.
With stakes, yeah.
Yeah, like I think you can compare it to The Sting or compare it to, you know, not necessarily a gangster movie, but we need to watch more heist movies to have more to compare it to. But you know what I'm trying to say.
Another thing that I discovered in my research is that Don Cheadle, as Basher, is actually uncredited in the movie.
Why?
I guess he was so embarrassed by his accent and his performance, and he has said that he was embarrassed to be paid for it. He was uncredited in the movie. His name doesn't appear. However, in the sequels, he does appear on the credits for the movie. But I think that is so funny. That's a fun little bit of trivia for you as well.
I didn't think his performance or accent was so bad that, like, I mean, it was fine. I don't think it's, like, took away
regarded,
from the movie, really.
It's regarded almost on the Dick Van Dyke level of bad British accents in cinema.
Wow, I didn't realise.
Yeah. But yeah, he got credit in the sequels. Also, we didn't talk about Bernie Mac. He doesn't get a lot to do in this first movie, though, does he?
No. He was great, though.
Yeah, he's good. And I mean, there's that one scene with the car dealer, and that's quite fun.
Yeah, he squeezes the hand. Yeah, that was good. That was good.
Mm.
Okay, well, you mentioned that... you mentioned that Don Cheadle was bad. You mentioned that Julia Roberts' storyline, not much to add. Is there anything else you didn't like about the movie?
To be honest, not that I can think of. I actually think it's, like I said, it's just a fun movie, and it's hard to fault a movie particularly when it's actually just really fun. It's not like it's trying to be serious, properly serious, and it's failing. Like you said, it's a bit of a, it works because there's stakes and there's tension, but at the end of the day, you don't watch this movie thinking it's a drama. You're watching it to be entertained, and it pulls it off so well.
It mixes them, doesn't it? Really, really, really well balanced.
The few flaws don't take away from the overall film at all.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think I have much else to say, actually, this week on the movie.
Well, should we give a score?
Yeah. What are you going to give it, Jordan?
8.5.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it an 8.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Is it going to crack the top 10?
It might do. It's got a score of 8.25. Which puts it at the same score as Jackie Brown.
Ooh.
Which means I think that it maybe just misses out on the top 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. It's 12.
That's still pretty good.
That is still pretty good.
So it just tops over The Usual Suspects, is that correct?
That's exactly right, yeah.
Wow. Wow. Well, Jordan will add that to the Podfather's Letterboxd visual guide.
I certainly will.
Which Jordan has kindly accepted responsibility of.
And you can see all of the scores, ladies and gents, on that list as well. If you look at the little notes next to each film, if you have it in list view, in case you're wondering what each film's score is as opposed to just its ranking.
Perfect. So now if you want to get involved and say, I don't agree with your score of 7.25 on Bugsy Malone, you can say what you would have given it. Or Black Mass, 6.75. Mean Streets, 6.25. Ocean's 11, 1964.
Though, this is the highest scoring film that we've done since The Dark Knight, which was movie 41, and this is 51. So this is the highest scoring movie in 10 movies.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. That's good. We've been a bit negative lately.
Yeah.
What should you tell us before we go and see Ocean's 8? Anything to say to get us excited, to prime us
what us I in will the dark? Say is, you know, I don't often like to give away what I thought of a movie before we talk about it, Alex. But what I will say is that I liked it. I'll start with that.
That's a little bit of a tease.
That's I won't say how much I liked it. I won't say anything more that I liked it. And I think it is a worthy installment in the Oceans franchise.
My expectations have risen. My expectations have risen.
Well, like I said, I don't want you to expect anything from it, but expect an Oceans movie.
Expect an Oceans movie.
Yeah.
I wanted to start today's off today.